how do we know that we're in a fifth beginning? Because it's hard to recognize a dramatic transition if you're part of it.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. This month, it's another literary episode. We'll explore Wyoming's past, present, and future through some notable books and articles from the past year. It's been a long time since a large market book has tackled the history of the Indian Wars in the American West, but a new one is out, titled The Earth is Weeping. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards chatted with author Peter Cousins about why he felt it was time to get people thinking about this tragic era in American history.
There has never been a major popular work on the Indian Wars that told the story in a balanced, even-handed manner from both the Native American or Indian side and from the white side. The standard work on the subject has for four decades been Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which, you know, is a passionately wrought and elegantly written book, but it made, D. Brown made no pretense at objectivity. You know, the subtitle is An Indian History of the American West. And the book was written in 1970, at a time when the nation was coming to grips with the many gross injustices done the Indians, coming to grips with this really for the first time in our history, kind of on the heels of the civil rights movement. And up until then, really, the story had been largely told from the point of view of white settlers, the government, the army, and the Indians were sort of one-dimensional cardboard cutouts. And so D. Brown took it to the opposite extreme.
You mentioned that most of the tribes were immigrants themselves that were kind of pushed west from sort of that eastern colonization. This was kind of a story of a lot of tribes that were kind of crashing into each other and weren't necessarily uniting under what you called Indianness.
Tribes in the West were never really that well unified on a tribal level. And Indian government was very loose. Chiefs could not compel compliance. Any warrior could go his own way. He could decide whether to obey the dictates of a chief when it came to making war or making peace. And there was a fundamental disagreement among Indians as to whether it was worth the pain and the suffering and the hunger and the time starvation that was entailed in resisting the overwhelming white encroachment on their lands, the overwhelming numbers.
And I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about, you know, what the overall strategy or philosophy of the U.S. government was during this time in dealing with the tribes. I mean, what was their goal in terms of how they wanted to handle the tribes as they moved into the West?
First and foremost, and this is one of the what I call the myths of the West that is unfortunately too often still perpetrated, the notion that the government somehow had a policy of physical genocide, of exterminationism. And that's absolutely untrue. The government never, ever, as a matter of policy, intended or desired to physically exterminate the Indians. The general policy that the government tried to follow throughout the Indian Wars was to congregate the Indians on reservations that were well removed from the overland travel routes, and then begin them on the road to what was generally called in those days, the euphemism was Christianization and civilization. The belief was that the only chance the Indian had to survive as a people was to become Christian white farmers. And that policy was pursued, you know, throughout the course of the Indian Wars, again, with varying degrees of success. I mean, treaties were broken regularly. Massacres did occur for a variety of reasons, but never as massacres never occurred as a matter of government policy.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role that the territory that eventually became Wyoming played in the Indian Wars.
Western Wyoming, things had pretty well settled down. There had been some clashes with the Paiute and some, again, in the parlance of the day, renegade Shoshone bands earlier. But by the end of the Civil War, the Shoshone, under the leadership of Chief Washakie, were firm allies of the United States government. In fact, Washakie was so highly regarded that the Army eventually named a fort after him. He was the only chief to be so honored. Eastern Wyoming and Northern Wyoming, on the other hand, were still very much in the hands of the Lakota. So there was a good deal of conflict, particularly in that part of Wighoming east of the Bighorn Mountains. That's where portions of Red Cloud's war took place against the Lakota.
Well, congratulations. This is a really wonderful book to read. It was just the actual writing of the book was a pleasure to read. I really enjoyed every bit of it.
Thank you. And I tried to make it a character-driven book to the greatest extent I could. I was always tried to keep in mind the importance of telling a good story first and foremost, and to, whenever possible, tell it through the experiences of not only the leading figures on both sides, but also from the point of view of the common warrior or of an Indian woman or a common soldier or a lower-ranking officer. So I appreciate your words in that respect.
We've been speaking with Peter Cousins, the author of The Earth is Weeping, the epic story of the Indian Wars for the American West. Thank you so much, Peter, for taking some time to talk to us.
Thank you so much.
Ernest Hemingway is almost as famous for the places he lived and visited, like Paris and Spain, as he is for his writing. Last summer, an article in Big Sky magazine explored Hemingway's Wyoming connections. The article's author, Darla Warden, became a Hemingway fan while attending high school in Sheridan. And she says the Sheridan area has its own Hemingway connection.
I was in college sitting on a bar stool at Last Chance Bar in Bighorn, Wyoming, and I noticed that there was a photograph of him over the jukebox.
You know, and I think of sort of the sketch of Hemingway's life, obviously when things of Paris, Spain and the Civil War, maybe Cuba, but Wyoming came as a surprise.
Yes, I think it surprised a lot of people. I had a lot of comments, especially from Wyoming natives, that said they had no idea. And not only that he loved Wyoming, but it was key to him that he finished A Farewell to Arms there and mailed it from the Cody Post Office, and then came back there every other summer until the late 30s. And then sort of when his marriage was falling apart, then he sort of switched allegiances and then started going to Sun Valley. So, you know, that was a good 10 years that Wyoming was his summer retreat.
And, of course, Hemingway is famous as a drinker as well as a writer. He was here during Prohibition for the most part. He wrote a short story called Wine of Wyoming.
Right. And that took place, that story, you know, based on something that really happened. You know, he uses real people and real stories, but then changes them and makes them fiction. And that story supposedly was about someone in Bighorn who made wine. So on his first trip to Wyoming, he drove up and stayed at Folly Ranch up on the Red Grade outside of Bighorn. And then when he picked up Pauline from the train station in Sheridan, they went up to Spiro Wigwam. And Spiro is now part of Sheridan College. And his cabin is marked there. And this summer on August 13th, I'm going to do a writer's retreat there just for a day.
And that's an offshoot of work that you do in Paris, where you have for a number of years now hosted the Left Bank Writers Retreat.
You know, it's funny. The Wyoming connection runs through this story because it started one summer when I wanted to work on improving my French and following Hemingway's steps from A Movable Feast.
You know, what strikes me, Darla, is the symmetry to all of this. You discover Hemingway in high school in Wyoming. Your passion for Hemingway takes you to Paris. You run this writer's retreat in Paris. And now this summer, you return to visit Hemingway's spots back in Wyoming.
That's so interesting because I never really thought of it. Like, it's full circle. And the funny thing, too, is as a high school student, I worked at the Sheridan Inn every summer and had no idea that Hemingway had stayed there and worked there. And so it's really exciting. I get goosebumps every time I discover something that's another Wyoming connection. I visited his cabin in Grand Teton National Park and saw where he came that first summer and fished. And it's kind of thrilling because we haven't read a lot about his Wyoming passion. And, you know, as a Wyoming native, I love Wyoming, and it makes total sense to me. You know, he was such an outdoorsman, and, you know, Wyoming is spectacular. So I think it just was sort of a, you know, when he discovered it, he just was so passionate about returning every summer.
Now, for you as a writer and for the writers who participate in your retreats, what is it about retracing the steps of a literary giant like Ernest Hemingway?
I've thought of this so many times and asked myself, is this some crazy obsession? Why do I feel so inspired when I stand outside his apartment, you know, in Paris, or when I'm sitting in the Luxembourg Garden? Why does that inspire me? And for me, I just keep thinking he arrived in Paris without any creative writing credentials. He had written for a newspaper and been a journalist, but he was really struggling trying to make a break. And he just worked on creating a different style of language while he was there. And I just keep thinking, like, could someone do that today? I mean, are there writers that are doing what he did almost 100 years ago? And also, he inspires me to improve my own writing. I really do try to take, you know, the message of simplicity and showing, not telling, and the tip of the iceberg technique, all of that. I think any writer can improve modeling themselves with some of his tips.
And so maybe you've already anticipated and answered my next question, but what is it about Hemingway that's so enduring still today? I mean, he lived from 1899 to 1961 and was in so many ways a man of his time, and it's a time that's not very much like our own anymore.
That's such a good point, the point that he was a man of his time, because, you know, he takes a lot of there's a lot of criticism about him, his personal life. But that criticism, I always think, you know, people judge the writing, not the man. It was a different time in the world. As far as his writing being relevant today, with so much talk about content, you know, and I think writing standards are slipping. And if people really took the time to model what he talked about in his own writing, which was, you know, using one word instead of two, writing words that you don't always have to go to the dictionary. I mean, he used words that were accessible to readers. And that might be why I loved him in high school, because to be a child in Sheridan, Wyoming, it was crazy to me, like, wow, there's a writer out there that writes about things like our life here, hunting and fishing and adventures. And it just was something that I could totally relate to.
Darla Warden is the author of an article on Ernest Hemingway's Wyoming in the 2016 fly fishing issue of Big Sky magazine. Darla is also currently working on a book about Hemingway. She joined us from her home in Denver. While Hemingway was vacationing in Wyoming, a phone company was getting its start. Back in 1914, John Woody started a Wyoming phone company that's now known as Union Wireless. These days, it's a multi-million-dollar corporation and one of the state's great success stories. Author Terry DelBene has written a book about the company called A Phone Where the Buffalo Roamed. He explains to Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck why this phone company has survived for over 100 years while others have faltered.
It was because that the founders of the company, they were willing to work at a loss for close to 75 years.
Is it true that they just really didn't start making money until about the 80s when they expanded and then of course, came wireless?
That's right. That's when the red ink turned to black. You know, up until then, you know, of course, there's money coming in and all that, but it's all getting sunk back into the company, approved services, the ad subscribers, things like that. They're building it very much like somebody might build a ranch and build the company. When they first started the company, they would hook up to a local exchange or something, and they would offer stock options, things like that. So, you know, it took decades for Woody to actually be chairman of the board of the company, because the stockholders were all the people from these other exchanges that had been brought into this union, hence the name.
It's so amazing to me that it's been basically this one family for so many years that really kind of kept the place running. I mean, how hard was it for them?
Well, it was pretty tough. They had some tough times, and, you know, they were running a small ranch operation on the side and growing their own food as well. And, you know, they started out very small, just family only. Then eventually they started adding occasional employees. And then it was, you know, once you have kids and they grow up, they go in and they help operate the company and learn the ropes. So it's a very tenuous line that they had to get through. There a lot of tough times. You think of all the economic up and downs for Wyoming, the boom and bust cycles. You know, in the boom cycle, everybody wants telephone service. In the bust cycle, they would spend the time improving the system and trying to build it out for when the next boom came along.
It does seem to me, and I think I got this from your writing, especially the boom maybe in the 70s that went into the 80s, that really was important for the company because it seemed to allow them to expand. Is that right?
Yeah, Flaming Gorge was the project that really solidified the company, but that boom as well helped them to expand services. And well, you know how Sweetwater County was at that time. It was just crazy, and they just couldn't hook people up fast enough.
Terry, as you look then, you know, we head into this time of deregulation and then certainly increased technology and that sort of thing. Was there a thought that the company might not make it through that?
Well, one of the interesting things in listening to the company folks talk about, they were always trying to stay on the cusp of the technological changes and to be part of that. So they positioned themselves very well. So the children seem to like to become engineers that deal in communications, and that helps them to do that. They're working with the telecommunications organizations. They're playing a leadership role in there. So for a little company in the middle of nowhere, they've got a lot more clout than you'd think.
You'd think it's the small business in Wyoming that people sort of forget about. We talk about a number of small businesses in our state that have existed and have done well over the years, but is this the one that maybe people don't think about right off the top of their head?
They probably don't, and you know what they probably don't realize is how big Union has become. They're actually providing service internationally now, and I know they've been talking about breaking into Asia. And when I was working on the book a couple of years ago, one of the board members was in Portugal arranging some data sharing deal.
It strikes me that if you would have probably heard some of the company folks 10, 15 years ago talking about where they wanted to be now, we'd have probably laughed at them and said, well, you know, good luck. But it's been really surprising, hasn't it, how far they've come?
It is. And when you think in 1948, things were so bad that they actually did offer the company to AT&T for a dollar.
And got turned down.
Yeah, and AT&T gave them the back of the hand, didn't think people out here in Sweetwater County and the areas around were worth the time it takes. So they dug in and they just worked harder, and now they're, you know, they have all these sweetheart deals with AT&T for different things. They picked up exchanges from AT&T. It's interesting to see the history of how the company developed. It's kind of like homesteading the airwaves.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is called A Phone Where the Buffalo Roamed, Collecting Neighbors in America's Outback. It's about Union Telephone, now known as Union Wireless. An interesting read about a small business here in Wyoming that has certainly grown. Terry, a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
This year, the community of Gillette has seen tensions with a Quran burning and protests over Gillette's first mosque. Writer and Pulitzer Prize winner Catherine Schultz heard this and wondered how a Muslim community came to be in coal mining Wyoming. She wrote an article this summer about Zarif Khan, a Muslim man from Pakistan who built a restaurant, a life, and a family in Sheridan at the turn of the last century. Many Muslims living in Wyoming today are his direct descendants. Schultz joined Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard to talk about the piece, Citizen Khan.
Catherine, thanks so much for making time to speak with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
So how did you discover Zarif Khan, a.k.a. Hot Tamale Louie?
So I came at the story kind of backward. I first got wind of some much more recent events in the state of Wyoming, which was the controversy over a mosque that had opened up in the town of Gillette. And I was dismayed about the controversy, but I wasn't terribly surprised. We're hearing stories like this all over the United States right now. But what I was interested in was, well, how did this, I know a little bit about Wyoming and I'd spent some time there. And I thought, I wonder how this Muslim community wound up in Gillette, Wyoming. And in trying to answer that question, I found my way to the really remarkable story of Zarif Khan.
And for those who haven't read the piece, Khan came to Wyoming. He founded basically a restaurant business, and he's kind of the patriarch of a lot of people, a lot of Muslims that still call Wyoming home. When you write a story like this one or any of your stories, what kind of intention do you go into it with?
I'm not a news reporter. I don't work for a daily newspaper. I don't have to kind of go out and every day just report that day's events in some kind of unbiased fashion. Of course, I have my own beliefs and opinions. Of course, I choose stories that interest me personally. And this, to me, was incredibly fascinating, the kind of clash between, you know, one strand of ideas in contemporary Wyoming that really rejecting the Muslim presence, and then a history with this exact same family where, you know, one of the most interesting things about Khan is that his religion was absolutely non-controversial in his day. Now, not everything about him was. He, very interestingly, was targeted and persecuted on the basis of race. He was regarded as Asian and therefore not eligible for citizenship. In fact, was granted citizenship and then had it stripped at the federal level. And so he, you know, in a very different way, he was kind of cast out from his society and culture at the time, but that wasn't happening on the local level at all. At the local level, he was embraced, and his religion was interesting to people, but utterly non-threatening. And it's just fascinating to me that 100 years on, we've, you know, somehow come to take that same family and consider them very, very differently and regard their religion as the most salient thing about them and regard it as somehow a threat to a nation that they have been a part of for over a century.
How did you go about reporting Zarif Khan's story, especially considering that so much of it took place 100 years ago or more?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it was really challenging, actually. It was very fun, but very challenging. He does have a lot of living relatives, including all six of his children. Unfortunately, they themselves, although they were wonderful in terms of giving me a feel for their father as a person, they were all quite young when he died. And so they actually didn't have a lot in the way of the real details of, well, what was his life like? How did he get here? What was he doing in 1909 and 1919 and 1929? And I would say they were as surprised as anyone else by what the record ultimately turned out to show. So a lot of the reporting was really archival. It involved, you know, finding immigration documents and court documents and going to libraries and archives and every imaginable place in this country where any kind of documentation is stored, right down to, you know, restaurant licensing. And then to some extent, truly just talking to the older population in and around Sheridan, Wyoming, where he lived and where he established his restaurant. He was such a beloved figure that, quite frankly, almost everybody over the age of 60 remembered him, and several of them worked for him in his restaurant when they were kids and were able to tell me a lot of firsthand stories.
Catherine, Stop Islam and Gillette, the group that you mention in your story, is no more. They've sort of gone off of Facebook. You can't really find them anymore. But groups with similar sentiment are still cropping up in Wyoming and around the country. Do you expect or hope that any of those people involved in those activities would read this story and change their thinking?
You know, I'm of two minds. On the one hand, I'm not arrogant or naive enough to believe that my words are going to make a difference. At the same time, I believe that people do change, people do think twice, and something has to provide that kind of tipping point. At least one of the people I talked to that was involved in Stop Islam and Gillette turned out to, I think, have very mixed feelings themselves, and then genuinely be, as most of us are, complicated people with different kinds of sentiments, depending on who they're talking to and thinking what they're thinking about in the moment. So what I do think is that culture is a collective thing, and we all contributed to it. And the more that we can kind of contribute alternative narratives and new ideas and different ways of thinking about things that are as easy to access and tap into and think about and take on as our own as these really hostile narratives, then we're doing the best we can.
Catherine Schultz is a writer and reporter. Her New Yorker piece, Citizen Khan, details the life and legacy of Wyomingite Zarif Khan. Catherine, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
As America contemplates its future under a new president, one man has been looking to the past for cues about our future. Robert Kelly, an archaeologist at the University of Wyoming, has written a new book called The Fifth Beginning. In it, he argues humanity has encountered four transition points, or beginnings, in its history: the invention of technology like stone tools, culture, agriculture, and the state. He sat down with Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard to discuss the period of transition humans are facing right now.
First thing we should say is, how do we know that we're in a fifth beginning? Because it's hard to recognize a dramatic transition if you're part of it. There was no hunter-gatherer who woke up one morning and said, hey, we're all agriculturalists now. My guess is that in the distant future, my archaeology colleagues will look back on this time and they will see that we are in the midst of another beginning, another time of great change, which began about 500 years ago. It's the era of globalization. It's marked by massive building, by what geologists call the Anthropocene, a massive impact of the human presence on Earth. We see it in the atmosphere, in the CO2 concentrations. We can also see it in things like the concentrations of carbon-14 in the atmosphere, which is a result of above-ground bomb testing.
I think something that kind of plays into it that you mention in the book is that as a species is adapting to one thing, they often become something else. So you mentioned how primates didn't mean to become bipedal. Hunter-gatherers didn't intend to become farmers. Farmers didn't mean to become part of empires. So what could we possibly be becoming?
There are three things at work today. For 5,000 years, we've been on an ever-spiraling upward in the cost of war. That's a function of someone developing new offensive weapons, so someone else has to develop new defensive weapons. The cost of war is now phenomenal. And yet that technology can't really be used. I don't think that we can fight another war like World War II, where we accepted massive casualties on our side as well as on the other side. Can you imagine the President of the United States saying, we're going to undertake warfare in some place in the world, and we expect 10,000 casualties. How would the American people respond to that? I don't think they'll accept it. So there's ways in which warfare simply it doesn't appear to be worth the benefit given the costs. The other thing that's happening is the global reach of capitalism. Capitalism operates on cheap labor. And the way it's finding cheap labor today is by moving to some part of the world where labor is cheaper. The U.S. moved labor to Japan after World War II. Then it's been moved to Singapore, to South Korea. Now it's in China. It's in India. And China is now building infrastructure in Africa because they fully expect to move their labor at some point to Africa. Africa is the last major landmass that has to have its standard of living raised up, which capitalism always does. Once it does that, there'll be no more cheap labor anywhere in the world. At the same time, capitalism seeks to reduce its labor costs through automation and artificial intelligence. What do we do when there's no more cheap labor and, in fact, industries don't need labor? Who's going to have any money to buy anything? So there's sort of a logical endpoint to that form of a capitalist economy. The third process that's going on is the cultural effects of a worldwide system of communication and transportation. People can experience other cultures immediately through social media, through television, through the radio, but also immediately through the appearance of new people in their neighborhoods, Somalis in Denver, for example. That process is having two effects. One of those, I think we've seen the result of it in the recent election. People are terrified. But there's the opposite reaction as well, where people are interested in cultural diversity. They're attracted to it. It's another way of living, maybe a way that has some solutions for the common problems that we all face. And it makes other cultures purely human. These are three processes that are at work today that their inevitable result will be to restructure the way the world is organized.
And you seem pretty optimistic about that, you know, end of war, global citizenship, the end of capitalism, that on one hand could sound to some people very utopian, to other people very undesirable. But you argue in the book that there is a way forward. Why are you so optimistic?
So I'm not necessarily a terribly optimistic person, but I decided to take that position in the book, in part because if I don't take an optimistic outlook, then there's really no point in even trying. You have to believe that things can get better, that we can create a better world. And I suppose that's part of the message. What's different about the fifth beginning is that we had no control over the first four. No one knew that they were happening. And today, we understand how economies operate. We've got a lot of knowledge, and we've got a great deal of power technologically. We can do almost anything that we want to do. There's no need for us to retreat into isolationism, which is the direction that our country might be taking. It's the direction that the UK took with Brexit. That's one way. That's one way that we can change the world. The easy way is to acknowledge where we're going to be in probably another century or so, which is a world that will have to be unified, that will have to operate economically in a way so that there isn't massive inequality in the world, because that will only generate resentment and fighting. We know how to restructure the world so that that doesn't happen. We can do that now, or we can do that later after a great deal of pain. I'd prefer to do it now.
Robert Kelly is an archaeologist and the author of the book The Fifth Beginning, which is out now. Thank you, Robert, so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And that wraps up this episode of The Modern West. More stories about The Modern West are at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Casey McNinch produced the show. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.